Hello and welcome to Worlds Apart. Some 30 years after the collapse of the Soviet Union, Russia is once again at a crossroads, trying to choose the path of its development. Going west no longer seems an option, especially after the events in Ukraine, but going east or turning east is not that easy either. Has Russia passed its point of no return, and where is it likely to go from here? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Nandan Unnikrishnan, Distinguished Fellow at the Observer Research Foundation in New Delhi. It's great to talk to you, sir.
Thank you for inviting me.
In one of your interviews, you said that you feel like an Indian cosmopolite, with Russia being your second motherland. You spent a lot of time here as a child and as an adult, as a professional working here. How do you feel about the current state, about the current circumstances of the country that you once openly called your second motherland?
Well, we have to keep in mind that my first motherland is India, and I look at the world through Indian eyes. Mm-hmm. And what is happening today in Eurasia, particularly between Russia and Ukraine, puts India in a very difficult situation. It increases the pressures that India is facing from multiple directions, and narrows the space that India has to take decisions. So from that perspective, of course, India is not very happy. However, India at the same time recognizes that it is not a binary question of you're either with us or with them. And therefore, India needs to exercise choices which reflect its national interests.
Mm-hmm. Now, India has had its own fair share of neighborly disputes, let's put it in diplomatic terms. But when it comes to the Russians and Ukrainians, again, I want to rely on your personal expertise or personal experience of this region. Do you think this feud between, you know, Russia and Ukraine, the two countries or the two peoples that used to call themselves brothers, do you think it was inevitable? Or was it, in a way, a man-made conflict?
Well, all conflicts between human beings are man-made. Mm. They're not inevitable. But yes, I think now looking back at history with fresh eyes, I think the tensions were developing between these two countries long, long ago. It was even before 2014. I would go back to the early 2000s. And I think that is the turning point when Ukraine felt that it wanted to move into the Western orbit, and Russia, as a big, great power, obviously felt that it needed certain countries to, on its borders particularly, not to be hostile to it, even if they're not with Russia, but at least they cannot be openly hobnobbing, as it were, with the enemy. Mm-hmm. And it is quite clear that Ukraine was headed into a very close embrace with Western countries. Mm-hmm. It was not just about membership in EU. There were military relations developing.
But can I ask you something? You said that it was not just about the membership of the EU, but the membership of the EU is a beautiful dream, perhaps, for the Ukrainians, but was it really ever offer to the Ukrainians in concrete terms? Because from the Russian perspective, Ukrainians have been used to the maximum by the military, in their military aspect, but in terms of offering them prospects of better life, democracy, etc., we the Russians don't see much there, but perhaps we are biased.
No, I would tend to agree. After all, even in till February 24th, 2022, I don't think anyone would say that Ukraine was an example of democracy. It definitely wasn't. Ukraine is a corrupt state. It was the lowest in Europe in terms of rankings. So all that is understood. I also would have to agree with you that Ukraine's membership in the EU did not seem to be something that would happen tomorrow. But I think there was a distinct worry that the military ties of Ukraine with NATO countries were developing much, much faster than Ukraine's economic ties with the Western nations. And that was the worry that I think governed Russia's decision. I'm not saying whether the decision is right or wrong. I'm not getting into that point of it. But from a perspective of an Indian, I can understand what has led to this decision.
Now, the Indian strategic thought has a long tradition, and I'm not even trying to compliment your country, but I think there is a certain dispassionate approach to events, even though some would argue that perhaps the most recent government has taken on a more emotional, on a more psychological tone. But generally speaking, the Indians and many other powers have this skill of considering what's in their interest and what's not in their interest, even when they deal with something that they don't like. And I think what many Russian analysts are noting in relation to Ukraine and in relation to the West is the absence of the strategic thinking capability. They call it the holiday of strategic thinking, because many of the decisions that NATO or other big players are taking seem to be contradicting their own long-term interest as well. Is that something that you also observe, or is it something that you would object to?
I would definitely disagree that this government is in India is a little bit more emotional. In fact, if anything, this government in India is far more transactional than previous governments. And I think, I mean, there is very little to pick on in this government's policies on foreign policy in terms of the Ukrainian conflict. And I think the foreign minister of India has said it in best terms. He says, we are not making a choice for the West or for Russia. We have made a choice for India. Coming back to lack of strategic thinking, I don't quite agree with that concept. You see, there are different ways of looking at Western strategies. There are debates even within the West. But one view is that Russia is always going to be an existential threat. So Russia must be weakened as much as possible. China is a threat and is probably a greater threat. But a strong Russia with China is a much bigger problem than a very weak Russia with China. So,
do you think the Russians and the Americans are defining existential threat in similar terms?
Well, these are the only two countries that are capable of totally annihilating each other. So they are an existential threat to each other.
And that justifies trying to weaken your adversary, because, I mean, a weakened adversary with nuclear weapons, you know, one could argue that it's a much bigger threat than, you know,
yes,
a strong
it's
one.
True, but a weakened adversary with nuclear weapons would also consider using them in the same manner as it would consider using them if it's not weakened. If that enemy is going to defeat me, then I may consider the option of, if the world doesn't want me, then why do I need this world? But I don't think the Americans are going to get Russia to that stage. It is to economically weaken. And as Austin said, I don't know whether it was a slip of the tongue or it was genuine. He said they want to weaken Russia so that it cannot rebuild itself to come to this stage.
Now, from your experience of this country, do you think that approach is going to work? Do you think the Americans are going to get the desired objective of weakening Russia by the set of measures that they're now implementing?
That's an easy answer, no.
Why not?
Russia is a country which has very serious depth, and the people of Russia are a category that have displayed a resilience. And just in the last century, they went through World War I, there was a revolution, there was the Second World War. There were many crises that they went through. There was 1991, the collapse of the Soviet Union, and yet we are here. So I don't think these economic sanctions and all are going to affect the people of Russia. Will it weaken Russia? Yes, maybe. That I don't know about. But will the people of Russia give up? will there be regime change or something? No, I don't think so.
There's something said about, and I hear that a lot on Russian television, that what doesn't kill us makes us stronger. It's, I mean, we've lived with this motto for quite some time, but it's also a little bit dispiriting. You know, you would want to look forward to something more uplifting. What's the benefit for the West in pursuing that strategy? Because obviously in this case, in the case of Russia, it already came back to hurt them. Why are they so oblivious to the pain that they are incurring?
Well, I personally, this is my opinion, that I think the West feels that, or the US specifically feels, this is the last opportunity it has to reclaim its hegemony. Its hegemony was being diluted. The unipolar moment was past, particularly in the 21st century. The events in Iraq and then in Afghanistan were showing that there appeared to be a decline in US power. And they feel that this is an opportunity to reignite the unity of the West and to regain the hegemony, because what is being threatened is not Ukraine alone, but what is being threatened from a Western point of view is the whole world order they created after 1945. And they want that hegemony of that world order to continue. And Russia is challenging that, undoubtedly.
But that world order, I mean, according to admissions of many American economists and political scientists, is no longer functioning properly even for the Americans. Do you think this fixation on hegemony, is it more pragmatic because it serves their interest, or is it more psychological in nature?
Well, that's a difficult question. But I think that there are many realist practitioners and theoreticians of international relations in the United States. But I have seen in the last 2-3 months that many of them are not being listened to. I mean, just look at the travails of someone like Mearsheimer and some others also. So it clearly indicates that the policymakers in Washington are pursuing a policy of maybe a certain mix of realism and idealism together. It's not the classical liberal interventionist policy, but it has elements of that in it.
Is it still a strategy, or is it just a set of haphazard decisions?
I don't know. I mean, I think that once you have that particular worldview, where you feel that the world order that you created is under serious threat and there is an opportunity to restore your control over it, I think anybody would want to believe that they have the opportunity and that they have the capacity to do so. The outcome of this will show whether they were right or wrong. But at this point of time, I would say the jury is still out.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, and at this point of time, we have to take a very short break. We will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
Пострадавших это были мирные жители.
На местах их дислокации были обнаружены массовые захоронения мирных жителей, даже беременных женщин.
Он однажды меня спросил: «Мама, как ты относишься к этим событиям, которые произошли в Одессе?»
Более 25 тысяч гражданских объектов разрушено. Более 2000 стариков, женщин, детей убиты.
Непонятно, по каких причинам украинский народ просто уничтожает сам себя.
Никогда, никогда после этого всего мириться или возвращаться в Украину, никогда.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Nandan Unnikrishnan, Distinguished Fellow at the Observer Research Foundation in New Delhi. Before the break, you mentioned a number of Western thinkers who are criticizing the current approach to American policymaking. And I also want to mention people like Henry Kissinger and Richard Haass, people who are part and parcel of the mainstream who have also been warning against upping up the ante indefinitely. And Henry Kissinger in particular returned to his, the message of his life that pushing Russia and China together is dangerous for the United States, and that the administration needs to do something to change that. Is there anything, as far as you are concerned at this point, that Washington can offer either to Moscow or Beijing to sort of encourage them to not necessarily change sides, but to change the trajectory of their development?
Well, I think Washington can do a lot. At the end of the day, while we are not in the unipolar world anymore, the fact is that the United States remains the most dominant power. So the United States undoubtedly has tremendous influence and has a capacity to influence events that are taking place in Europe right now. And I think what India has been saying for many days now is that what is required is an end to bloodshed and a diplomatic solution to negotiation to try and resolve the differences. And the United States definitely has the ability to get Ukraine mm-hmm. to the negotiating mm-hmm. table. For some reason, they are not exercising that. Mm-hmm. And I can only imagine that that is because they feel that Russia's capacities are not yet weakened sufficiently.
We are speaking on the sidelines of the Valdai Discussion Club, and people who belong to this conference sometimes voice an opinion that one of the strategies that the Americans are pursuing is essentially similar to what you guys have between India and Pakistan, this policy of mutual containment that takes a lot of resources, that keeps both countries locked onto each other, instead of pursuing other development opportunities. Do you think there may be something to that, that the Americans or the West would love to see Russia locked into a permanent feud with one of its fairly large neighbors for the sake of keeping it busy and perhaps for the sake of some bloodletting, both literal and economic?
Well, yes. I mean, I can imagine that if someone in the United States makes that analytical decision or comes to the analytical conclusion, that Russia does not have the capacity to fight more than on one front, and therefore, if it is engaged with Ukraine, it will not be able to react to situations in other parts of the world, then yes, I mean, it would seem to make sense to do so. But I am not sure that that calculation is a correct mm-hmm. one. And it's a risky calculation to make, so that is one. Mm-hmm. I definitely don't think that the situation between Russia and Ukraine is the same as the one between India and Pakistan. Although some of the original motivations for this differences of opinion could be very, very similar.
Now, for the time being, we've discussed the geopolitical implications, but I also want to touch on economic and social aspect of this crisis, because India has just banned its wheat exports after recording some of the highest price hikes in a decade. Do you consider that as one of the unintended consequences of the Ukrainian affair?
No, I mean, the question of what is happening with wheat is definitely a problem of the Ukrainian war, or it's unintended maybe, but it is a consequence of that war. That is point number one. Point number two is, yes, India has decided to prohibit exports except in certain exceptional cases. But there is a twofold reason for this. One is it was to protect the prices within the country and to ensure that food security would be protected within the country, because if the prices abroad are much higher than in the country, the temptation to export would be much, much greater. That is one aspect. The second aspect is it was also worried that international traders would end up buying and hoarding and driving prices further up for the rest of the world. So India has said that, and is in talks with countries like Egypt and all, for supplies wherever the lack of wheat has created a humanitarian crisis. And government to government agreements on supply will be made wherever a humanitarian crisis has to be avoided.
I know that New Delhi also cited a scorching heat wave as one of the factors, and we are seeing more and more of such extreme weather and nature events, you know, droughts, heat waves, locust invasions, etc. It looks like India is actually stocking up, not for the rainy day, but for something far more dangerous. Is this the right perception, that the decision makers in New Delhi may be fearing that the current situation in the world may worsen rather than improve?
I don't think that will at this point of time be the main concern. But yes, climatic conditions are a concern. And in India, agriculture is very monsoon dependent. The monsoon is yet to come. It's predicted to be a decent one. But we have to wait and see. If the monsoon is good, then I don't think India will have any troubles producing grain, but of all kinds, not just wheat. But a lot will depend on that. Are we hoarding because we are worried that we may not have a good monsoon? I'm not so sure. Because even storing wheat, at the end of the day, you have to protect it in certain conditions. Maintaining those conditions is very, very difficult.
And I think India is storing not only wheat, but for example, I just read that Russia has risen from 10th to 4th place among India's oil suppliers, so you are buying a lot of Russian oil as well. Despite some disencouragement from the West of not doing that. It looks like you are stocking up, no?
No, I don't think so. Firstly, India's capacity to keep reserves of oil is limited. That is point number one. Point number two, when you go to the supermarket to buy things for your house, if you see something on sale, don't you buy it? We are getting cheaper oil. I mean, it's a no-brainer. We will buy it. If you're getting oil at a discount, we will buy it.
But it's also a political decision, because there have been a number of talks between Narendra Modi and Joseph Biden, when Joseph Biden tried to persuade India of not to do that, not to take that Russian oil. Why do you think they did
it? It is also clear that after those talks, Joseph Biden is not doing anything about what he wanted, right? Because he understands from his perspective, from the American perspective, if the main adversary is China, and this is about managing China's rise, then it requires a strong India to join that particular strategy. And nothing that Russia is doing with India or India is doing with Russia is weakening India, but only contributing to India's strength. So to that extent, I think the United States is rational enough to understand that it can try and persuade India, but it should not try and push India too much.
So the American persuasion doesn't work on India. Could it work the other way around? Do you think the Indians could use that influence with the Americans to try to at least communicate to them that the effect on third countries of this wave of sanctions is perhaps undesirable on humanitarian grounds? Because I'm sure you've heard that many world economists are warning about the possibility of mass hunger, about you know, major social disruptions in third countries that have nothing to do with Russia or Ukraine or the West.
Tell me any nation that you think can influence the United States.
Well, I think actually a tail can wag a dog in many ways. And Israel, for example, is a good example of that.
Israel is part of US policy. It's domestic policy in every sense. Israel cannot exist without the United States. But Israel is not a tail that wags the dog of United States. It's quite the opposite. Mm-hmm. Irrespective of what Israel may want to project.
The United States has been courting India for quite some time, and they've given you lots of exemptions from the previous sanctions. They need you for their rivalry with China, perhaps for their rivalry with Russia as well. Do you think India's bargaining power has increased as a result of the hostility between Russia and the West?
Well, India currently is in a sweet space in that sense. It definitely has room to maneuver. But the conflict between Russia and Ukraine has definitely reduced that space. Mm-hmm. And it has, you know, when there is tension between two powers that are of consequence to Indian strategy, and both USA and Russia are consequential powers for Indian international outlook and approach to the world, then it does cramp India's ability to evolve and pursue policies that are in its interests. So India would like to see the tensions between the United States and Russia reduced. And obviously that would mean that we need to end as soon as possible the conflict in Ukraine and move into a more diplomatic mode of resolution.
Mm-hmm. Once things move into a more diplomatic mode of resolution, Russia will still have to decide how it wants to develop. And it's pretty clear that it could not be incorporated into the Western institutions the way it thought it could be. 30 years ago, there are certain limits to developing its partnership with China as well. Relying on your knowledge of Russia, where do you think it's going to be, let's say, 20 years from now?
Russia has a lot of factors which are of tremendous advantage. Russia is a large country, it's the largest in the world. It has a humongous amount of natural resources. It has a highly educated population, a very talented population, and it has the ability at times to mobilize its human and financial resources to achieve particular goals. This happened even in the Soviet Union. This is Russia is capable of doing it even today. So therefore, I think if Russia has 20 years of peace, as it were, I think Russia will be also in a very good space. It would be more developed, it would be stronger. But the question is whether the current dominant powers in the world would like a stronger Russia. And I think this whole thing that we are seeing playing out in Ukraine is precisely about trying to reduce that possibility of a strong Russia emerging. But yes, can Russia become strong without the West? Yes, Russia could.
Well, as we like to say in Russia, let your words reach God's ears. On this beautiful point, we have to leave it here. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for inviting me. Thank you.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart next time.